From Altoona to Lebanon, St. Mary's to Reading, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGIE, is a solution in search of a problem. So says Greg Wrightstone of the CO2 Coalition. He is here to explain why. The Barber National Institute provides high-quality services to children and adults with autism and intellectual disabilities. Joe Geiger has Patrick Barber of the Institute in the Community Benefit Spotlight. And relaxed healthcare regulations to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic have shown us how to reimagine the delivery of healthcare through expanded scope of practice. Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity talks about it on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Greg Wrightstone of the CO2 Coalition in just a couple of minutes, but first we have news headlines from patownhall.com. Hearings into the conduct of the 2020 presidential election got underway in the state Senate this past week after internal discord within the Republican caucus resulted in State Senator Doug Mastriano being replaced by Senator Chris Dush as chairman of the committee looking into the election. This followed a dust-up between Mastriano and Senate President pro tempore Jake Corman over Mastriano's handling of the investigation. A similar series of hearings was held during the spring by the state House that resulted in election reform legislation, which was ultimately vetoed by Democratic Governor Tom Wolf. There does appear, however, to be some proposed reforms with bipartisan support. Those issues will be taken up by the General Assembly when it returns to session next month. A new bill proposed by State Representative Andrew Lewis of Dauphin County would redirect billions of dollars in Pennsylvania public school funding to individual scholarship accounts for each child. According to the Center Square, the Excellence in Education Act would allow families to use the roughly $6,000 the state spends per student to pay for tuition at private, parochial, or charter schools. More and more parents are seeking alternatives to traditional public schools in the wake of COVID-19-related restrictions such as mask mandates. Lewis's bill would provide middle and lower-income parents with the ability to afford such options. Along the same lines, State Representative Eric Nelson of Westmoreland County says he will introduce the Pennsylvania College Voucher Program that would redirect more than $580 million in taxpayer money that is exclusively allocated to the University of Pittsburgh, Temple University, and Penn State University directly to students. The Center Square reports the program would provide grants directly to students who are interested in technical schools, community colleges, private colleges, or schools within the state system of higher education. Hearings on the proposal will get underway in October. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Pennsylvania's proposed regional greenhouse gas initiative relies on faulty data. That is the conclusion of a well-researched scientific report published by the CO2 Coalition. Gregory Wrightstone is executive director of the CO2 Coalition. He joins us now to explain why the initiative is, in his words, a solution in search of a problem. Greg, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Greg, we're going to get into the details of your report on the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. We have talked about it many, many times on this program. However, for those who may not have heard of REGGIE, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, before, or maybe forgotten what it's about, give us just a little overview of what the program would be.
It's a carbon taxation scheme, tax and trading initiative, whose primary role, and this is focusing on electricity generated from fossil fuels. So that is coal and natural gas. So it doesn't affect nuclear or wind or solar. So this is the goal here is to drive up the cost of the electricity that's generated by both coal and natural gas in order to make the others, primarily wind and solar, the renewables, appear more economically attractive, and they become more likely to be used by consumers and businesses on the open market. So the primary objective is to drive up energy costs for Pennsylvanians. It's a scheme Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, a group of northeastern states as far south as Virginia. By the way, North Carolina just rejected it, thankfully, and we hope that Pennsylvania will do the same. We'll talk about the specifics. So we have about a 10-year track record of what happened in those other states that actually entered into the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And from now on, we'll be calling it REGGIE for short. And we have a track record of what exactly happened. And did they drive down their emissions? And the other question is, if they did, is that a good or a bad thing?
Your organization, the CO2 Coalition, has put out a very comprehensive report on REGGIE, and it's subtitled A Solution in Search of a Problem. So you're not really seeing a problem here.
Well, we look at it by almost every metric you look at. The Earth's ecosystems and humanity are thriving, benefiting, and prospering. It stands in complete contrast to what you're being told every day by the media, by the recent UN report. We can go through the facts of what we're actually saying, and I do that, and then we do that in this report. In my section of it, I say, okay, the governor is saying we need REGGIE because of this, 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 and this. And I went back through and looked at this, 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 and this, and said, no, you're wrong. By almost every metric, we see the crops are setting records year after year. The floods, the governor talked, and we'll go a little bit more detail about that in a few minutes, but the floods aren't increasing like the governor says they are. Drought's not increasing like he says they are. And the seas aren't rising any faster than they have for the last 150 years. So, no, we see an Earth that's thrived. The modest warming of 0.8 of a degree since 1900 doesn't sound alarming to me, combined with increasing CO2, it's just turbocharging what we call the greening of the Earth. Vegetation increases in almost every niche environment is increasing, and that's a good thing. That's a very good thing.
In your report, you talk about the fact, Greg, that the governor, Governor Wolf, and those who are pushing REGGIE are relying on something called a climate action plan. But you've done an analysis of that, and you found that the facts don't quite square with what the plan says. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Oh, it was horrible. It was, I believe it was published in 2018. There's been a recent update to it. This report relies on the one, it was published before the publication of this most recent report that was published, I think, 3 weeks or so ago. But no, it's an alarmist bunch of just factual misinformation. And what we did with our report, I took a look, it was really in three parts. I was the lead author of this report. And I looked at the justifications. They're saying, okay, we have to, you know, the climate's changing, and it's because of us, and all these bad things are happening. And they were listed as Governor Wolf's justifications to impose this climate taxation scheme on Pennsylvanians. And I went through each one and just said, no. The first one that he looked at was precipitation's increasing, and it's leading to catastrophic flooding. Well, I went through that, and is precipitation increasing in Pennsylvania? Yes, very modestly. And if we look, I have a chart in there that goes back to the year 1895. And since then, there's been a slight increase of precipitation. That's about 4 inches per year. So you spread that over, that's about an inch, about a third of an inch per month. Pennsylvania, that's just a light rainstorm that you get any particular day. I went back through and then looked at flooding from the Susquehanna River Basin, from the Ohio, and also up at Williamsport, looked at Bucks County. And all in each case, both the flood crests and the number of floods are in decrease. And then get this. Now, remember, the first one, increasing precipitation alone, and you can't make this stuff up. And number two, justification of why we need to do this, he said, well, droughts are increasing. Well, which is it? Increasing precipitation or increasing drought? You can't have both happening at the same time. Any rational, you don't have to be a scientist to understand that that's just false. And they went on, again, droughts, and I showed statistics showing that, no, droughts are decreasing in Pennsylvania. The other claim was heat waves are increasing. Again, we went back and looked at the statistics. No. In Pennsylvania and across North America, the heat waves peaked in the 20s and 30s and have been in decline since. So we just went through each one of these. He stated In their justification for RESI, they stated that health risks from worsening air and water pollution will increase because of worse. I went back to EPA. I looked at their data. Our air and water of every pollutant is decreasing. The pollution has been decreasing. Looking at the EPA data, we're getting cleaner and cleaner every year. Our air and water haven't been this clean in well over 100 years, and we're getting better every year. I mean, for crying out loud, the highly polluted Three Rivers of Pittsburgh, just horrible. They're holding bass fishing tournaments in all three rivers there in Pittsburgh. So, no, we're seeing increases and bettering of our air and water. And they claimed that sea level rise was going to lead to flooding in the Philadelphia area in the southeast because the river there is tidally driven. And I went back and looked at the Philadelphia tide gauge of sea level rise. Sea level there, is it rising? Yes, it's been rising since the mid-1800s. And we're rising at the same rate as we did 120 years ago. There's been no increase. In case after case, we saw the governor's proposal and his justifications were proven false. And it was by a long shot he was wrong.
Not only, Greg, do we have these climatological errors in this report, but RESI also is claiming that there's going to be a financial advantage to the economy, to the Commonwealth by doing this. But their economic model's flawed also, is it not?
It is. We had David Stevenson, who's the director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Caesar Rodney Institutes of Real. He's probably the top expert on, well, he isn't probably, he is by far, on the economics of RESI. And he took a look at it. And the big claim that RESI makes is that, or the people in charge of RESI, is, well, we've seen a decrease in emissions. And that's a fact. They have. Those states saw a decrease in emissions. And you say, okay, well, that might be a good thing. I disagree because as you know, I've got a bumper sticker on the back of my SUV that says I love CO2. But let's just say for the moment, that's a good thing. It's not, though. They saw a decrease in emissions. And why did that occur? Because energy-consuming companies that are making widgets that use a lot of electric moved out of state. They shut down fossil fuel-fired energy sources and moved that out of state. So what they did, the emissions were exported to surrounding states that were not part of RESI, if you follow me. So that widget manufacturer moved over to Ohio. So they're still making widgets using the same amount of electricity, but they're not making it in Rhode Island or Vermont anymore. They're making it in Ohio or West Virginia, or it might be Pennsylvania. And that's what's going to happen here. In addition, instead of creating electricity using fossil fuels, they're importing electricity from other states that are using fossil fuels. So they're not actually, they see no net, David saw no net decrease in carbon dioxide emissions. And that was their main goal in this whole thing.
We have been talking with Greg Wrightstone. Greg is the executive director of the CO2 Coalition. They have put out a report. Pennsylvania's Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative relies on faulty data. Why RESI is a solution in search of a problem. Greg, tell us a little bit about the CO2 Coalition and where can folks go to read this report and a whole wealth of information that you have on your website.
You can go to co2coalition.org. We're a group of more than 70 of the top climate scientists or scientists studying climate in the world that are, we have physicists, astrophysicists, climatologists, I'm a geologist, gifted people, and we all believe, and we support strongly this notion of benefits that are accruing to the ecosystems and humanity, the human conditions improving, again, because of the combination of modest warming and increasing CO2. My philosophy for climate change is we should use all of Earth's resources for the betterment of mankind and do it as good stewards.
Greg Wrightstone of the CO2 Coalition. Greg, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Loman.
The Erie-based Barber National Institute provides high-quality services to children and adults with autism, intellectual disabilities, or behavioral health challenges. To learn more, Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has Patrick Barber of the Barber National Institute in the Community Benefit Spotlight. Joe?
Thank you, Loman, and thank you, Patrick, for being a guest in the Lincoln Radio program. Patrick, tell us a little bit about what inspired the Barber family to start this National Institute for People with Autism?
Our organization, the Dr. Gertrude A. Barber Center, began in 1952 by my great aunt, Dr. Gertrude Barber. Dr. Gertrude Barber was an administrator with the Erie School District, and in her position often had to tell parents that their choice with their children with intellectual disabilities was either to have their child sent to a distant institution or keep them at home because there weren't any programs for their education within the school district. Gertrude could not accept this. She had a doctorate in special education from Penn State, and she began the organization in the basement of a local Boys and Girls Club and YMCA. And it really grew from there. And now today we serve over 5,000 people with intellectual disabilities, ranging from anywhere from birth all the way through when the individual is deceased. And so she was a true visionary of where this industry needed to go and was the first in our neck of the woods, and I believe in the entire state of Pennsylvania, to provide services and education to people with disabilities.
It seems like the education system still wrestle with what's the best way to serve the autism community. We've seen a lot of improvements because of the number of programs that are going on now, but why aren't we a little further down the road in our school systems with identifying it and partnering with organizations like yours?
I can certainly understand that sentiment, and I believe that there's a special understanding that needs to be given to the various school districts and organizations throughout the Commonwealth. And I think providers like us that really specialize in these services can provide that. We have a lot of experience advocating for and providing services to people with intellectual disabilities. And I think there's a wealth of knowledge within not just our organization, but other providers such as us to teach the school district and to teach anyone that would be interested to how to provide an adequate and appropriate education.
From looking at your website, it does appear that this is a family-driven organization. Dr. Barber founded the organization in 1952, and there are a number of Barbers featured on your website. What's unique or what's challenging or what's great about having your family together in on the project?
That's true. So Dr. Gertrude started us in 1952. She had no children of her own. And when she was getting towards the end of her lifetime, brought in my father, John Barber, to groom him and to prepare him to be her successor. And so I think it's really been an interesting life for me and my siblings. We've always been around the Barber National Institute, and it's something that we hold near and dear. And I think really the strength of it is that we see the organization as something that needs to continue whether or not we are at the helm of it.
Yeah, it's interesting because many nonprofit organizations are started with people who have a family member dealing with a physical or emotional or intellectual challenge, like Milton Hershey. His wife could not bear children, and they started a school for orphans. And your grandmother didn't have children, and she started a program for people with autism. It's a commendable dynamic that I think is unique to the United States, and I think very commendable.
We are honestly very grateful for Gertrude's vision, and she was a person that saw a big need, and she decided that she was going to be the one to fill that need. And so I certainly can't take any credit, nor can my father or my siblings, but we really take seriously the expectation that she had, which was to continue her mission and to deliver excellent service to people with intellectual disabilities.
So you inherited the inspiration. This is Joe Geiger in the Lincoln Radio program. My guest today is Patrick Barber. Patrick is with the Barber National Institute, in primarily out of Erie, Pennsylvania, and many other locations across the state. Patrick, serving 5,000 children with autism must require an army of employees. You want to talk a little bit about your employee base and what they contribute to the cause?
So our employees are some of the most caring and selfless individuals that I've come across in my lifetime. The folks that work for us and for providers such as us, they have such an enormous heart, and they really see the potential in each individual that they're serving. And I think that's really what we do is all about. It's about seeing the potential in each individual and to allow each child and adult with disabilities to be the best person that they can be, because we all deserve a life of dignity and respect, and our employees deliver on that every day.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Patrick Barber with the Barber National Institute in Pennsylvania. Patrick, if people listening to the program want to find out more about you or donate money or volunteer, how can they find you?
You can go to barberinstitute.org. That's barberinstitute.org. That is our flagship website. And from there, in a top right-hand corner, you can donate. There's also a lot of opportunities on there for being a volunteer. We have several events throughout the year, and we can certainly always use any help whenever we can with those various events, and of course, day-to-day helping out with projects around the headquarters. So we really appreciate all the volunteers out there, and we encourage anyone that's interested in giving or volunteering to contact us, and we'll be able to reach out to you.
Congratulations to your staff, and especially to your family members who are investing their lives in the work of people with autism. Thank you for being a guest on the program again. Back to you, Loman.
Expanded scope of practice paved the way for the delivery of healthcare services during the COVID-19 pandemic. On this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary, Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania says it is time to make those relaxed regulations permanent.
The COVID-19 pandemic and the response of governments at all levels to it has been a clarifying moment for many Pennsylvanians in terms of how they view the manner in which they are governed. The most concrete expression of citizens' attitude toward their relationship to state government took place in Pennsylvania this past May, with the passage of two constitutional amendments that restore checks and balances to the state's emergency management process by shortening the length of a gubernatorially declared emergency from 90 to 21 days and requiring legislative approval to renew an emergency declaration after the original declaration expires. The existence of the governor's COVID-19 emergency declaration also shed new light on the vast array of regulations that Pennsylvania's businesses, workers, and families must navigate on a daily basis. The governor's emergency order provided for numerous waivers from many state regulations related to health care, professional licensure, and many other activities essential to the day-to-day functioning of most aspects of life in our Commonwealth. Well, not surprisingly, in many cases, the waiver of these regulations resulted in little to no negative impact on the quality of our health and safety, and in fact were essential to keeping the Commonwealth functioning as well as it did in the face of business shutdowns and other government-imposed restrictions on individual liberty. However, as a consequence of the General Assembly's vote to terminate the governor's COVID-19 emergency declaration, those waivers were terminated along with it. This was not an insurmountable problem. Indeed, it forced the governor to work with the General Assembly on temporarily extending a number of those waivers. Well, now nearly 100 professional licensing waivers are in need of permanent extension, including those which temporarily eased regulations to allow for extended temporary practice permits, expanded scopes of some practice for certain healthcare professions, and allowed retired licensees to join pandemic response efforts more easily. This must be accomplished by September 30th, and it presents an opportunity for both the governor and the General Assembly to again collaborate in improving healthcare outcomes for Pennsylvanians. One profound way to do this would be to finally pass Senate Bill 25. This would remove archaic restrictions on advanced practice registered nurses, or APRNs, that no longer reflect modern medicine and the delivery of healthcare. Under Senate Bill 25, the State Board of Nursing is to establish an advanced practice registered nurse certified nurse practitioner license in areas of expertise consistent with their training and focus. This replaces the current state certification requirement. Additionally, after meeting a 3-year, 3,600-hour physician collaboration agreement, APRN CNPs would be permitted to practice to the full extent of their education and training by removing the requirement for a formal collaborative agreement currently required for them to practice and write prescriptions. This, combined with the new licensing standard, will allow APRN CNPs to provide healthcare in an environment free from unnecessary administrative burdens that have outlived their usefulness. It would also help to expand healthcare access in areas of the Commonwealth that are underserved under the existing system. 22 other states and the District of Columbia currently allow nurse practitioners full practice authority. To learn more, visit healthcarereimaginedpa.com. By passing Senate Bill 25, we can ensure greater access to higher quality care at a more affordable cost to Pennsylvanians from Erie to Philly and Pittston to Pittsburgh. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director with Americans for Prosperity. You can find us on Facebook by searching at PAAFP and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 26 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WCCS-AM and WLYC-AM in Indiana, along with WFYL-AM in Jeffersonville, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.
We'll be right back.